Driving through Hopkinton today, you can't miss the three-tower-wide power line corridor that streaks through the town. But they were a surprise to many residents 25 years ago when they were installed.
It was days and days of these gigantic helicopters bringing the towers in, and I had no idea what was happening.
Realtor Joni McIntyre was living in town at the time and still sells many houses in Hopkinton. She and fellow realtor Judy Hampe took me for a drive along Phase 2, a high-voltage direct current power line that passes through town and connects Canada's massive hydropower dams to New England. Back in the 1980s, neither McIntyre nor Hampe had heard about the line, not even when pushback in the North Country meant relocating the first section of it, called Phase 1, into Vermont's Northeast Kingdom.
They all of a sudden were big power lines coming through, and I wasn't happy about it, and I thought at the time perhaps there should have been a little more controversy about it.
In the last 25 years, the prospect that a new power line could avoid controversy has decidedly shrunk. There are important differences between Phase 2, which is owned by National Grid, and the Northern Pass, proposed by Public Service of New Hampshire and its parent company, Northeast Utilities. For starters, Phase 2 was built almost entirely on existing rights of way and between two existing power lines, whereas PSNH will have to cut 40 miles of new right of way and along much of the existing corridor will have to cut back the trees to fit the additional power line. Also, the towers tend to be shorter, around 85 feet tall, though some are higher. But there are historical echoes between the two projects, too.
You'll have to understand the environment at the time.
Peter Brown is an energy lawyer with Prady Flaherty, who represented the state's concerns when Phase 2 was up for consideration.
There was a consistent fear of dependency on foreign oil. We had, in New England, in particular, suffered from the oil embargoes because we were oil dependent.
In 2014, it's not oil dependence everyone's talking about. It's concerns over climate change and the region's use of natural gas for more than 50% of its energy. That's the case being made by the head of the Northern Pass, Gary Long.
Time is of the essence. Time is of the essence. We expect problems this winter. The ICE independent system operator, New England, is afraid there won't be enough fuel to make electricity this winter, because of the heavy dependence on natural gas.
But despite the similarities in the energy markets, Northern Pass has generated a much more staunch opposition, which has bought up easements to block the route, put up signs all over the state, and turned out en masse to important votes at the State House. Unlike Phase 2, the Northern Pass fight looks more like the drawn-out battle over the Seabrook nuclear power plant. This has led some observers, like lawyer Peter Brown, to predict that the Northern Pass will be okayed over objectors, just like Seabrook, and erected all along the length of the state, just like Phase 2, to carry even more hydropower into the region.
I would think the project would be approved, notwithstanding its opposition. Why would the SEC say anything but, okay, make sure you don't put a tower in the middle of this brook? Or, you know, you watch out for an endangered species over here, move it this way or that way. And don't go along a famous ridge line in the White Mountain National Forest. If you do all of that, you're on your own.
The SEC that Brown just mentioned is the Site Evaluation Committee, a 15-member group made up of state bureaucrats that evaluates energy proposals. When Phase 2 came before this body in 1985, the opposition was focused on the uncertain health impacts of living near a high-voltage transmission line. Brown says he remembers one North Country farmer at a hearing in Colebrook standing up before a room full of utility executives to declare,
"I don't want my tractor to start up without me on it."
But ultimately, these types of concerns weren't convincing. Bruce Ellsworth, a longtime but now retired New Hampshire electrical regulator who sat on the SEC during Phase 2, says at the time, the science didn't support the health argument.
The arguments that they gave were not persuasive enough in Phase 2 to cause the project to be denied.
And evidence of health impacts hasn't exactly piled up since that power line was approved. But most opponents to Northern Pass have shifted to a different focus, the aesthetics of the towers themselves. And on that front, there's a precedent. Last spring, the SEC gave a thumbs down to a small wind farm proposed for a ridge of low hills in the town of Antrim. Amy Manzelli, who represented opponents of the wind farm, says the decision makers said the enormous turbines would appear out of scale and cause significant qualitative impacts.
It was the aesthetics that they found to be dispositive.
In other words, the Antrim decision shows it might be convincing to argue before the SEC that steel lattice towers passing through the White Mountains or the woods of the North Country would be too much of an impact.
It's not an automatic yes. When you go before the Site Evaluation Committee, they do, and perhaps overdo, consideration of every aspect of the law.
But while it's no sure thing that the Northern Pass will make it through the SEC, the biggest threat to the project may not come from bureaucrats, but politicians. In September, Governor Hassan wrote an editorial in the Boston Globe in which she proclaimed, "Exploring new energy sources like large-scale hydropower does not mean just accepting what Northern Pass has offered." And on the other side of the aisle, there's State Senator Jeb Bradley. He has a long history of working out deals with PSNH on thorny issues. But if his rhetoric about the utility is any indication of the broader sentiment in the statehouse, the project may be standing on quicksand.
Northern Pass is not headed toward the finish line. They're not even at the starting gate at this point.
Northern Pass is just one of several open fronts between the legislature and the utility. Its competitors want regulators to force Public Service to sell its power plants, and they want to block it from getting paid back for a $422 million scrubber on a power plant in Bow.
The debate about the scrubber is making people like me, you know, test their hypothesis that it's too expensive to bury the lines. I don't buy it. I don't buy their argument that it's too expensive when they were off by, you know, almost a factor of sevenfold in terms of estimating what the cost of electricity would be on the scrubber.
In the coming weeks, the House of Representatives will vote on a bill that would direct the SEC to automatically consider transmission lines that aren't buried to have an unreasonable impact. It stands a fair chance of getting passed, and if it does, it would seriously hurt Northern Pass's chances with the SEC. PSNH says that could also sink $1.4 billion in construction spending, 1,200 construction jobs, and $28 million per year in local, county, and state tax revenue. Not to mention the potential carbon reductions for the region from importing more hydropower. Even PSNH's Gary Long seems to admit that the project stands on shifting ground.
So yes, I mean, we wouldn't be proposing this project if we didn't think it had public benefits and public merit. And but is it a certainty? No, not by any means.
But if Northern Pass in some form or another is eventually constructed, what then? That's what we'll look at tomorrow. Would we get used to it? Would the fears of opponents of the project be realized? For NHPR News, I'm Sam Evans Brown. There's this idea that a fisheries scientist came up with called the shifting baseline. It says we take for granted whatever world we are born into. Take New Hampshire, for instance. Ecological historian Karen Alexander says the Granite State is full of baselines that have shifted.
I mean, 100 years ago, New England was filled with farms. And there weren't the vast forests that you think of in New Hampshire and Maine and Vermont. Most of it was farmland.
This is perhaps why, amid the uproar around Northern Pass, there has been little attention paid to the people already living with similar kinds of power lines.
Okay, so there's my power lines.
John Turner lives in Goffstown, and National Grid's Phase 2 line, which uses the same technology proposed for Northern Pass, is about 300 feet from his back porch. He doesn't have a problem living near them.
I grew up where our Little League field was abutting power lines. And I remember those spring days where we were playing baseball and you could hear the hum and the crack and the hiss of the power lines.
But at the same time, that doesn't mean he likes them.
I think what I have in my backyard every time I drive under them is an eyesore.
Turner's house is in a development that hugs the Phase 2 right-of-way. And as I made my way down the street knocking on doors, nobody really seemed bothered to live near them. Of course, going to a development built underneath power lines obviously yields a biased sample, because anyone who really hates them won't buy a house so close. These are folks whose baselines have shifted.
So, let's hop out for a minute.
But that's southern New Hampshire, where many have moved to get their kids into good school districts or to be close to jobs. When you drive about 100 miles north of Goffstown to Sugar Hill, you find folks like Nancy Martland, who have a decidedly different baseline.
I don't really know people down there. It's hard for me to compare the communities, but I know here people treasure the landscape. They view this as an unnecessary insult, and they're just not willing to accept it.
Martland, a vocal Northern Pass opponent, is standing at the top of a prominent sledding hill on the western side of Sugar Hill. She and other opponents say the impacts of the power line would be worse in the North Country, where there are more people who have moved north for the mountains and the views.
Why should anyone be asked to get over something like that when there's no need for them to have to get over it?
Martland says she sees power lines everywhere now. She drives under the Phase 2 line pretty frequently.
And I'm horrified when I see it. I'm horrified every time I see it, and I see it a lot.
Surveys show that people like Martland, who were around before a controversial power line is built, tend to continue hating it for a long time, much more strongly than newcomers. That's perhaps no surprise. But that people like Martland exist in the same world as people who would happily buy a house next to a power line is emblematic of the fight to characterize the impacts of the Northern Pass project. One side of the debate loudly proclaims that the project would destroy New Hampshire's scenery, fundamentally changing the character and culture of New Hampshire and driving away tourists and second home buyers, while the other side declares that the project would eventually blend right in and have no impact whatsoever on the property values of abutting homes. It's next to impossible to quantify to what degree some of these claims have merit, but the best proxy we have is property values. Will people still be willing to come here? To bolster their claims, the project's critics point to the experience of realtors in the North Country like Andrew Smith.
What we're seeing on a day-to-day basis is buyers choosing to not buy, and that's having the bigger impact than actually price reductions, because it's putting people in a horrible financial situation because they can't sell their property at any price.
Smith, who has sold homes above and below Franconia Notch for 20 years, says his firm represents about 20 properties that simply aren't selling because they're near the proposed route.
The fear of the unknown is a huge impact right now.
But at the same time, there's a large body of research that has looked statistically into the effect that power lines have on property values, and it's by no means conclusive.
Some of the general findings, and some of these may be somewhat counterintuitive, but some of the studies found really minimal impacts on property values.
Thomas Jackson is a real estate appraiser from Texas who has a PhD for his work studying these kinds of impacts. He says about half of the studies done in different parts of the country and often in subdivisions and suburban areas find no impact on property values despite the concerns of communities.
They have concerns, and you know, I'm not discounting any of those concerns and perceptions. But a lot of times that in the long run, it doesn't get borne out in the marketplace.
But sometimes there are impacts. A study of Canadian homes funded by Hydro-Québec in 2002 found that in some scenarios, homes can lose an average of 10% of their value. But it takes having a tower right in plain view of the front door. That's the case for one property in Goffstown. Megan Terrio and Jeff Pinard have a striking view of the transmission corridor. Their driveway spills out practically underneath the towers.
We couldn't afford to be in this neighborhood if it wasn't for this house because of the fact that it was near power lines.
But in that same neighborhood, a half dozen homeowners said they didn't think they got a good deal in the slightest for buying a home near the power lines, like John Turner.
Back in 2005, there was no, the properties were limited. To buy something, a house this size, you had to buy where you could in this area.
And that same Hydro-Québec study found that some houses, ones that were on the right-of-way but didn't have a view of the towers, even tend to sell for slightly more. That's because a view looking out onto an empty right-of-way has certain advantages, says the study's author, François Desrosiers.
They can go naked in their living room without being bothered by neighbors.
So, to put it simply, and without providing any real conclusions, throwing up a power line might take a big chunk out of the value of certain homes, but many may not be affected at all. Hopkinton realtor Judy Hampe, who has sold homes near the Phase 2 line for over 20 years, says the studies don't tell her much.
There's always a buyer for everything, and it just takes a little bit longer to sell the homes that are by power lines.
She drove me around to look at the various homes she sold that abut the Phase 2 right-of-way. She says there are so many variables, from the characteristics of an individual home to the market it's sold into, that impacts can really only be determined on a case-by-case basis. And simply, not everyone cares about seeing the pylons. Not everyone has the same baseline.
I would say about 50% of the market really cares.
So would the state get over Northern Pass if it were built? The answer is likely something along the lines of some would and some wouldn't.
I suppose if Northern Pass got through in 30 or 40 years, people would look at it and say, oh, well, that's just those big power lines. We seem to be capable of getting used to a lot.
Karen Alexander notes fights over many big developments, like the highway through Franconia Notch, have come and gone and been all but forgotten.
But I don't think that whether we can get used to them is really the right question. I think the question is whether we should get used to them.
In a lot of ways, those are the hard questions.
Well, yeah.
And tomorrow, we'll continue looking at a few of those hard questions. Namely, if Northern Pass doesn't get built, what new source of power will come online in New England? For NHPR News, I'm Sam Evans-Brown. In just a couple of weeks, companies are scheduled to have a chance to bid for the right to supply electricity to New England in 2017 in something called the Forward Capacity Market. President of the New England Power Generators Association, Dan Dolan, explains this market's job is to make sure the lights will stay on 3 years out.
And what it does is it's really a reliability market. It ensures that there is going to be enough power plants on the system 3 years from now to meet consumer demand.
And this year, for the first time in the market's 8-year history, there might not be enough plants signed up to deliver in 2017.
We're seeing a transition away from some of the older generating stations, particularly the coal and the oil facilities, where they still play an important role on the system, but there have been a series of retirements that are taking place.
The Vermont Yankee Nuclear Station will switch off at the end of the year, and Brayton Point, New England's largest coal plant, has announced it wants to shut down in 2017. At the same time, our neighbor to the north has got hydropower to spare, especially in the summer. A spokesman for Hydro-Québec, Gary Sutherland, says most people in Quebec heat with electricity, so their grid is built up for really high use on the coldest days.
So there's a lot of surplus energy in the summer, definitely, that we can export.
Electricity prices in Quebec are low, which means exporting boosts Hydro-Québec's profits. In 2012, exports, mostly to New England and New York, accounted for 15% of sales volume, but 24% of its sales revenue.
Working on those export markets is a really interesting part of our business.
PSNH's Gary Long puts it another way.
They very much want to do business with New England. In simple terms, it takes transmission lines, and that's been the difficulty.
The trick about getting from where the hydro is to the demand in Boston and farther south is what's in between.
To get from Canada to New England, New Hampshire, Vermont, or Maine.
Here in New Hampshire, the Northern Pass has hit major opposition because of impacts associated with the lines. But not every proposal to move power south looks like Northern Pass. Opponents have plenty of examples of proposed alternatives to point to. One to New York City buried under the Hudson River, another proposed in Vermont would be buried under Lake Champlain, and a third in Maine would be buried along Maine's highways. PSNH has repeatedly said burying the line through New Hampshire would be prohibitively expensive, but the Conservation Law Foundation's Christoph Korshain is confident that if PSNH backs down, someone will step up who's willing to bury the line.
If that's what it's going to cost, then it's important that the developers know it's going to cost that. And if some of the developers lose some interest, my suspicion is that there are other developers who can make the spreadsheets work.
And these days, it's all about the spreadsheets.
We made a decision in the 90s.
Meredith Hatfield, New Hampshire's Director of Energy and Planning, says in the 90s, we decided to move to a market-based system for electricity, trying to drive down costs.
We were going to join a market and really try a market approach. And if we feel like the market isn't working, I think we have an obligation to try to fix it.
If New Hampshire doesn't like the projects the market is providing, policymakers have to figure out how to change that. Hatfield says the conversation is underway right now about changing the state's rules for siting new power plants and adopting a new state energy plan to guide developers about what the state wants.
I mean, we really are at an interesting time where people are asking fundamental questions, and that's a good thing. When we did the last energy plan, there wasn't this level of public interest in these issues.
Whatever the conclusions, New Hampshire is going to have to decide how, if at all, it's going to help the region replace its aging fleet of power plants, with or without Northern Pass or Hydro-Québec. For NHPR News, I'm Sam Evans-Brown.